Well, welcome everyone. We'll get started. And if you don't have a Bible, I encourage you to grab one. They're available in the entranceway.
You've got three. You've got three. Does that mean we should have three?
It's all about numbers.
It's to give the illusion of authority and knowledge. Yes, the illusion. We have been looking at theologies of creation found in the Hebrew Scriptures, and not creation in the sense of kind of how things came to be, but how the Scriptures and biblical faith lead us into living, into being residents of or members of creation in a particular way, and encourage a kind of ecological awareness of our membership in this great web of creation. And so we looked at Psalm 104 for a couple of days, and yesterday we began an investigation of Job and the extraordinary end of the book of Job, especially that in which Job is taken on this kind of magical mystery tour of the wonders of the created world. And we're going to continue that today, and we're going to start just before the beginning of chapter 39. So if you go to chapter 39 of Job, and if you'll recall this, I don't assume that everyone is here yesterday. Was everyone here yesterday? Everyone that is here now here yesterday? Yeah. Okay. So we know where we've arrived, and that is Job has been involved in this dialogue with his so-called friends who have been basically trying to convince him that he's done something terribly wrong to deserve all this suffering, and Job has maintained his innocence. And finally, at the end, God appears to Job out of a whirlwind and speaks to him. And this torrent of questions begin to just come from God about creation. And that whole chapter 38, most of chapter 38, is kind of about the physical universe, from the stars to the oceans, and kind of asking Job what he, has he kind of plumbed their mysteries? What does he know about this physical world? And at the end of the chapter, we arrive at starting to talk about some very specific animals then. And that's where we're going to pick up. There's a series of eight animals after this kind of tour of the heavens and kind of the wonders of the physical or the geographical, geological world, astronomical world. We arrive at animals, and there are eight that we hear about. And so, picking up at verse 39 of chapter 38, and we hear about a lion, a raven, a mountain goat, a wild ass, a wild ox, an ostrich, a war horse, a hawk, and an eagle. And so let's start there. Let's read slowly, and don't hesitate to jump in and ask questions of things that particularly jump out at you. So would someone read verses 39 to 41?
Can you hunt the prey for the lion, or satisfy the appetite of the young lions? When they crouch in their dens, or lie in wait in their covert? Who provides for the raven its prey, when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food.
And then starting at chapter 39, verses 1 to 4.
Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth? When they crouch to give birth to their offspring and are delivered to their young? Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go forth, and they do not return to them.
Here we begin a very specific kind of question to Job is about, is he one who is aware and engaged at the very specific processes of life that are going on actually around where he lives? Those mountain goats, do you pay attention? Those ravens, are your eyes open? You know, it's very concrete, very specific, and some of this stuff could as well be about our own valley right here.
It's interesting, like, and I think we touched on this yesterday, but he really doesn't form an answer to the nature of good and evil. I mean, God, you know, knows when the mountain goats give birth, feeds the ravens. He doesn't talk about when the young go starving. Is it God withholding God's hand? Or is it simply that God is in the giving of creation?
That's a good question. There's death to come yet in later in chapter 39. So that may get at some of that question. But it seems to me that the question of good and evil is sort of almost off the table in at this point in Job. That it's simply the great wonder of it all, that it's kind of beyond good and evil, it almost seems. It just is. At least that's how it reads to me.
I think also a thought I've had going on this idea of it's bigger than it all. Back in 28, verse 28, there's this line, has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? And kind of that in conjunction with all these other things, it's like, from a modern perspective, we can say, well, scientifically, we can kind of deduce how this happens. But it's still, we're just putting names to things we're observing. We're not really understanding this bigger, that rain can occur. Earth happens. There's still this bigger picture thing.
Right.
That maybe we can name it, or I could count how many months, but I still.
There's always some another layer to peel back.
Right.
You never get all the way back.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point, and it. I think that helps to open up that these questions are as valid in a scientific age as they are in a pre-scientific age, because they're asking.
They're unanswerable.
They're unanswerable questions. You can never get to the bottom. Yeah. How about verses 5 through 8?
Who has let the wild ass go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift ass, to which I have given the steppe for its home and the salt land for its dwelling place? It scorns the tumult of the city. It does not hear the shouts of the driver. It ranges the mountains as its pasture, and it searches after every green thing.
Significant, I think, that these are all wild animals. They're not domesticated. It's the wild ass. It's not the domesticated donkey we're talking about here. And so again, it's the wildness, the untamableness of this natural world that seems to be a central point of what's unfolding here. 9 to 12, is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will it spend the night in your crib? Can you tie it in the furrow with ropes, or will it harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on it because its strength is great, or will you hand over your labor to it? Do you have faith in it that it will return and bring your grain to your threshing floor? Sounds like the wild ox can be domesticated, or they make attempts at it, but it remains pretty untamable. This part about the ostrich that's coming up is particularly interesting. Would someone read that, 13 to 18?
The ostrich's wings flap wildly, though its pinions lack plumage. How far?
To 18.
For it leaves its eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that a wild animal may trample them. It deals cruelly with its young as if they were not its own. Though its labor should be in vain, yet it has no fear, because God has made it forget wisdom and given it no share in understanding. When it spreads its plumes aloft, it laughs at the horse and its rider.
The ostrich was sort of regarded as an absurd creature, which kind of is. And Lamentations even calls it particularly cruel, the ostrich, the way it treats its young. But even that, even the kind of oddness of the ostrich is sort of within the realm of this created order, and it's kind of even deepens the mystery because of the strangeness of this huge flightless bird. And then we come to the horse, a war horse, it seems. Verses 19 to 25. Would someone read that?
Do you give the horse its might? Do you clothe its neck with mane? Do you make it leap like the locust? Its majestic snorting is terrible. It paws violently and exults mightily. It goes out to meet the weapons. It laughs at fear and is not dismayed. It does not turn back from the sword. Upon it rattle the quiver, the flashing spear, and the javelin. With fierceness and rage it swallows the ground. It cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, it says, aha! From a distance it smells the battle, the thunder of the captains, and the shouting.
The horse here seems to be contrasted with the ostrich. The ostrich being a sort of absurdity, and the horse is kind of presented as being just grand and majestic, an animal used for warfare. Here we have something that an animal that is domesticated, but yet you know it's presented as being just. Certainly, kind of, there's a kind of untamableness to how it's presented, and a grandness to the horse. And the next section, we come to Laurie's question about, you know, where's blood, where's death, and is God's presence only in kind of the giving of life? So. Verses 26 to 30.
Is it by your wisdom that the hawk soars and spreads its wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes its nest on high? It lives on the rock and makes it home. in the fastness of the rocky crag. From there it spies the prey. It eyes it from far away. Its young ones suck out blood, and where the slain are, there it is.
That's all we get. Young eagles sucking up blood. It's a really stark vision. It's like just this is it. This is creation, and it's good. In life and death, there it is. There's certainly nothing done here to present creation as something really even for people. It just is. And there's the eagles lapping up blood. It's a little different vision from Genesis 2 and 3, where the garden is sort of given into the hand of Adam and Eve. You don't have any sense of that here. It's a very kind of creation. It's very starkly real and little else.
But that's quite in contrast to the experience that I had the first time I went to Juneau, Alaska.
Mm.
And I said, well, where do we see the eagles? And they said, you go to the dump.
Interesting. Any thoughts on that catalog of animals that unfolds there and how that fits into kind of the broad themes we've been thinking about?
I can't help to think that this is like God's way of addressing Job in a way that we can understand his previous suffering by pointing out the animals that surrounded him while he was going through all his trials. So like I see like, you know, like the, you know, like it's just like from the lion, you know, just, you know, providing for his family, not being able to do that, not being able to protect his family, and, you know, like, but yet they're in the wild, you know, maybe while he is suffering, there's, you know, a pride of lions that just had their fill, you know, there's the eagles who are being provided for. So it's not like, I don't know, like I see this like parallel where like it's not like a universal suffering, or it's like one experience of suffering is actually in contrast to, you know, the group of animals across the valley, you know, that amidst that suffering, like there's like almost like a different understanding of God that can be integrated, like, you know, from letting go of, like, you know, say Job's, you know, expectations, or I don't know, just like having had an easy life, you know, just being able to look at the wild ass and being like, okay, well, you know, this supposedly these learned teachers, you know, are now turning against me, or not turning, they're not supporting me, you know, perhaps there's a wildness of my own that I can trust, or, you know, like I just see this dialogue between the animals and how Job might be able to really, I don't know, start to, you know, see the parallels.
Other thoughts?
I wish I could, hear the original tone of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel, at first I felt sort of, it was a mockery of humans trying to understand suffering, but as we kept going, I wondered if it was more like a gentle reminder, you know, even being whispered, there's so much that we don't know, and just mm-hmm. a gentle reminder of it.
Yeah, and I think there's ambiguity, especially at the end in the Hebrew, of when Job kind of relents or repents and says, woe is me, I relent or repent in dust and ashes. It's unclear as to, it could be interpreted as repent. It can also be interpreted as sort of I'm consoled. Mm-hmm. At sort of seeing the wonder of creation and kind of recognizing the mystery of God. And so the question of how we read the tone of all this is a good one. Yeah.
How do you square the beginning? God brought this on Job as kind of like a sport, which isn't a very warm and fuzzy view of the Creator, and then he blows this I'm all powerful, and that's and you're just a small piece of creation, but it all started out with him making sport of a bet with the devil. How do you put that together?
Yeah, well, you know, I was reading an interesting commentary on that was saying, one thing it was saying is that we, the Satan, as we read it, it's not pitchfork and a red forked tail and a pitchfork. Ha Satan, the Satan, is a kind of just part of the, probably better translated as the accuser or the accuser perhaps. But it's kind of part of the divine counsel. This isn't kind of what we kind of in through medieval Christianity came to think of as like this. It's not the devil in a sense. It's not what we think of as the devil. And what this commentator said is that you could think of the place of Ha Satan here as one who. That human beings' relationship to God, a mature one, isn't based upon sentimentality, but is based on is based upon kind of seeing reality clearly, not based upon warm and fuzzy feelings or just projections of what we want God to be, and that the story of Job is in part the story of Job encountering kind of the truth of reality, and so then having a kind of a reality-based relationship with God, and not just a kind of one that's based upon his own is just based upon the fact that he had good fortune and was prosperous. That's one way to interpret it. That's how this person interpreted it. I thought that was interesting.
I wonder if the setup at the beginning didn't have to do with making it clear that, I mean, regardless of the bet piece, you could say that God is responsible because God, you know, entered into this bet, but you could also say that it's a way of storytelling that frames it in such a way that God does not actually strike down Job's family or take away all of his. I mean, it clearly like delineates that the figure of God was not at hand in the chaos that happened in Job's life. Sort of
yeah, but he also says, "Let it be."
Yeah,
which that means, I mean, in our society, that means you're part of the problem. You allow it to happen. Mm-hmm. You could have intervened. You didn't. You're liable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also Well, go ahead. Did you want to say
sure, yeah. I was just going to say, in this whole, talking about all these animals, there's usually, picks out one thing that they do. Where the one thing is highlighted. It was, so like one principal character that animal is highlighted. And in this conversation with Satan, the Lord says, very well, only do not stretch out your hand against him. And all these things around Job happen, and even to his very health, things happen. But maybe the principal thing for Job is his ability to say, blessed be the Lord, or to... And so maybe...
That's his integrity that he's trying to hold on to.
That's the thing, is it doesn't really matter your life or your health or all these other things, but the principal thing about humans has to be being able to bless the Lord or have some kind of understanding of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's a commentary on that as well. Of, all these other animals have this principal character that makes them who they are.
The connection you're making.
But what makes humans who we are is our ability to... And perhaps maybe what they're saying is this is how these other animals bless the Lord. This is how they give in. But how you do this, that's your principal thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. We are all animals.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really interesting take on that. I want to keep us moving because I'd like to get us more or less to the end. And chapter 40 takes another kind of wild turn in this survey of creation. We go from chapter 39, which is this series of very specific animals that Job is asked if he is aware of, if he sees, if he takes note of, if he observes. And then at the end, the beginning of chapter 40, God addresses Job. And the Lord said to Job, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? Anyone who argues with God must respond. Then Job answered the Lord, see, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but will proceed no further. So Job declines God's offer to say anything at all, puts his hand over his mouth. And then we move from this kind of catalog of the known world, if you will, to this very fantastical, mythological tour of creation with these beasts, two kind of mythological beasts, Behemoth and Leviathan. So I want to take us there because it just gets fascinating, even more fascinating and strange. Beginning with verse 15. And here you have, throughout, Job has been getting these questions, these unrelenting questions about the natural world. And then God tells Job to look at things which are clearly mythological, which is an interesting thing. He says, look. Look, at, starting with verse 15 of chapter 40. Look at Behemoth. Now, Behemoth seems to be some sort of mythological hippopotamus or something. And I'll show you what William Blake, how William Blake renders it. There we go. So here's Behemoth and Leviathan. I think that's Job and probably his wife, and I think those are Job's comforters, Job's friends there, kind of huddled on the side. But Leviathan is this wild creature. And Job is counseled to look at Behemoth. So I'll start reading it at verse 15. Look at Behemoth, which I made just as I made you. It eats grass like an ox. Its strength is in its loins, and its power in the muscles of its belly. It makes its tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of its thighs are knit together. Now I'll just pause in that verse there. One of the things that makes Job difficult to interpret is that it's full of words that occur nowhere else in the Hebrew Scriptures. And one of the peculiarities of the Hebrew Scriptures is that there is no other text which uses ancient Hebrew. We have no other text except the Bible. So there's no way, unlike the New Testament, in which there are countless, there are just endless documents written in Koine Greek, from, you know, ancient grocery lists to literature and philosophy, that where we got giant lexicons of that we can check a word over against other usage if it only occurs once in the New Testament. And you don't have any way to do that with the Hebrew, because it's a self-contained document, and there's no other to check it against. So there are quite a number of words, especially in Job, that occur only there. And this is one, this verse. And if you read that, you can probably guess that our translators are kind of trying to be a little genteel in their translation. Clear enough? I don't need to spell that one out. Thanks. Moving on.
No, sorry.
Okay, I will read the more likely translation from the Jerome Bible Commentary. Leviathan stiffens his penis like a cedar beam. The sinews of his testicles are closely knit. More likely translation. But there's a lot of conjecture, because some aspects of that don't occur elsewhere. So there's guesswork involved. Its bones are tubes of bronze, its limbs like bars of iron. It is the first of the great acts of God. Only its maker can approach it with the sword. For the mountains yield food for it, where all the wild animals play. Under the lotus plants it lies, in the covert of the reeds and in the marsh. The lotus trees cover it for shade, the willows of the wadi surround it. Even if the river is turbulent, it is not frightened. It is confident, though Jordan rushes against its mouth. Can one take it with hooks, or pierce its nose with a snare? So there is the great Leviathan. The great Behemoth. Next comes Leviathan. And both Behemoth and Leviathan seem to be kind of based in a potential creature, such as a hippopotamus in the case of Behemoth, or maybe a rhinoceros, but then become wildly kind of fantastical. It's kind of imaginative rendering of one of these animals. So we come to Leviathan, whom we've encountered before, and would someone start reading? And and Leviathan takes up all of the description of Leviathan takes up all of chapter 41. And so would someone start reading there? And read as long as you want until you get tired.
Or you can pull in, this is from a message though, or you can pull in the sea bait beast Leviathan with a fly rod and stuffing in your creel? Can you lasso him with a rope and snag him with an anchor? Will he beg you over and over for mercy, or flatter you with flowery speech? Will he apply for a job with you, to run errands to serve you for the rest of your life?
Will you play with him as if he was a pet goldfish? Would you make him the mascot of the neighborhood children? Will you put him on display in the market and have shoppers haggle over the price? Could you shoot him full of arrows like a pincushion or drive harpoons in his huge head? If you so much as lay a hand on him, he won't live to tell the story. What hope would you have with such a creature? Why, one look at him would just do you in. If you can't hold your tongue against his glowering visage, then how can you expect to stand up to me? Who could confront me and get by with it? I'm in charge of all of this. I run this universe.
I will not keep silence concerning its limbs, or its mighty strength, or its splendid frame. Who can strip off its outer garment? Who can penetrate its double coat of mail? Who can open the doors of its face? There is terror all around its teeth. Its back is made of shields and rows, shut up closely as with a seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. Its sneezes flash forth light, and its eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. From its mouth go flaming torches. Sparks of fire leap out. Out of its nostrils comes smoke, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. Its breath kindles coals, and a flame comes out of its mouth. In its neck abides strength, and terror dances before it. The folds of its flesh cling together. It is firmly cast and immovable. Its heart is as hard as stone, as hard as the lower millstone. When it raises itself up, the gods are afraid. At the crashing, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches it, it does not avail, nor does the spear, the dart, or the javelin.
Anyone else want to bring us to the end of the chapter?
It counts iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make it flee. Sling stones for it are turned to chaff. Clubs are counted as chaff. It laughs at the rattles of javelins. Its underparts are like sharp potsherds. It spreads itself like a threshing sledge on the mire. It builds the deep boil like a pot. It makes the sea like a pot of ointment. It leaves a shining wake behind it. One would think the deep to be white-haired. On earth it has no equal, creature without fear. It surveys everything that is lofty. It is king over all that are proud.
What do you think of Leviathan? Ever seen one?
It's the boogeyman that we experience as a child.
Yeah, right? It's some sort of dragon figure. You start out thinking we're talking about a whale, but it quickly becomes clear that William Blake, I think, is closer to what's being described here. What's the role? What function? I mean, ancient people would have known that this is as fantastical as we do. What's the function of, how does a description of such a fantastical creature, what function does it have in these chapters of Job?
Seems like a projection of terror.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Embodied terror.
Yeah. And Job was counseled to look at this. Look at Behemoth and look at Leviathan.
Beware.
Beware. Here be monsters. Yeah.
But he says he can haul him around on a little string.
Right.
He can control. God can control.
Right. So that's part of the point, I think. that this, the kind of mystery and terror of it all is in the end in God's hand too. Yeah.
Do you think in the original people who read this or wrote this, were these creatures something, I mean, obviously fantastical, but how would their interpretation of those creatures differ from ours? And then, I don't know if you have a sense of that.
Yeah, no, it's a terrific question, and I don't have any idea.
Because I wonder if it might be a commentary if let's say, you know, these, our understanding that these are created creatures of saying, even you humans, even the things that you come up with, you come up with things that only God can control, or only God has some sense mm-hmm. of power over. I don't know, that idea of powerlessness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe just your worst nightmare I can control.
Well, yeah. But who's read the book or seen the movie Where the Wild Things Are? Mm-hmm. I mean, this looks actually like it's right out of the book. That's a children's book about nightmares and scary things that go bump in the night. Which have tremendous power in our lives mm-hmm. and in our world.
This seems to give power to imagination,
mm-hmm.
to creativity.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like God has created this thing. You can't touch it, but you can feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Because our imaginations are powerful.
Yeah.
Well, does he really have to create these two beasts? No. These are Job's imaginations. This is the worst thing you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
It's nothing to me.
Hmm. Even that's in my hand. Yeah. Yeah. Getting a little bit back to what Andrew was saying about how would these a creature like this have been understood, I think, I mean, part of the answer to that is that the Leviathan creature was in mythology of the time in across Middle Eastern cultures was representative of chaos and a kind of force opposing God in some way. So in that sense, that would have been a live. It had a lot of cultural meaning for people then. And we've run out of time, but I wanted to look a little bit into more of what. In other parts of the scriptures, what Leviathan represents. Leviathan is certainly a force of chaos, sometimes the kind of chaos of the sea and the threatening, overwhelming power of flood and God's power to kind of subdue all of that for the well-being of creation and to kind of create a habitable world. So there are various places, other places in Job and Isaiah, Ezekiel, the Psalms, where Leviathan is and God kind of talking about God crushing Leviathan and these sorts of things. So a kind of a force of chaos opposing God. And really interesting thing in the ancient rabbis talked about the messianic feast, the end of all time, when God will reign. And talked about that the menu of the Messianic feast was Leviathan cooked up and served to humanity. And is that potentially behind that symbolism behind the two fish in Jesus' feeding stories? Does that symbolism sit behind the two fish idea of Jesus' feeding stories? And those feedings being
a messianic banquet, and that being symbolic of Leviathan at long last being served up, chaos conquered, being served up to the people. It's an interesting idea. I've always puzzled about where those fish come from, or what those fish are about. I want to just look quickly, and then I've got a quote that I'd like to end this with, and that is beginning of verse 42. Job, the second time, is questioned by God. Then Job answered the Lord, "I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge?" That was the first question that God gave to Job at the beginning of in chapter 38, at the beginning of these questions. Who is this that, so Job repeats back to God the question that he had been given before. "Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have stuttered, but I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me." Again, Job repeats back to God the question that had the statement that had been given to Job previously. "I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." I'm really curious about that. "My eye sees you." They've been going through this whole recital of seeing the natural world. And so Job has been encouraged to see the natural world, and then Job responds to God, "I see you." I find that very interesting.
There's an interesting note about, it talks about Behemoth and Leviathan.
Yeah.
And it goes into saying how Behemoth is Hippo, and Leviathan could possibly be symbolized by the crocodile, and how this is like reflective in the Egyptian icons where the god Horus, which is like this, you know, big-eyed owl, is the one that is fighting these two creatures, and it's supposed to be thought that like he's the one that's controlling the forces of chaos, or god Horus, which is all about vision.
Yeah. So very interesting. All about vision. Yeah. Yeah. So for Job, all of this leads to his kind of throwing up his hands, repenting or recanting. It could also be interpreted as consoling. "I am consoled," and that he and so there's a question of tone that is open to interpretation. And here's William Blake at the end takes considerable liberties with this text. And when Job says, "I have seen God," Blake interprets it as seeing Christ, which is definitely reading a lot into the text. But I want to close with this quote from Annie Dillard, because I think that she here captures very much the spirit of these chapters of Job. "The world is full of creatures that for some reasons seem stranger to us than others, and libraries full of books describing them. Hagfish, platypuses, lizard-like pangolins, 4 feet long with bright green lapped scales like umbrella tree leaves on a bush hut root, butterflies emerging from anthills, spiderlings wafting through the air, clutching tiny silken balloons, horseshoe crabs, the Creator creates. Does he stoop? Does he speak? Does he save, succor, prevail? Maybe. But he creates. He creates everything and anything. The Creator goes off on one wild, specific tangent after another, or millions simultaneously with an exuberance that would seem to be unwarranted, and with an abandoned energy sprung from an unfathomable font. What is going on here? The point of the dragonfly's terrible lip, the giant water bug, birdsong, or the beautiful dazzle and flash of sun-lighted minnows is not that it all fits together like clockwork,
for it doesn't, not even inside a fish goldfish bowl. But what it all, but that it all flows so freely wild, like the creek, that it all surges in such a free, fringed tangle. Freedom is the world's water and weather, the world's nourishment freely given, its soil and sap, and the creator loves pizzazz.
Seems to me she captures something about these parts of Job.
So we'll continue tomorrow. Our last day, we'll look, continue this theme, and we'll look a little bit at Proverbs and the Gospel of John.